The Continental by the original George Shearing Quintet. That's George on piano with Marge Hyams vibes, Chuck Wayne guitar, John Levy bass and Denzel Best drums. And that's all from me for this week. I hope you've enjoyed this trip down memory lane. And in the grand jazz record request tradition, there's no programme next week owing to opera. But I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. And now, here on BBC Radio 3, it's time for Jazz Lineup with Julian Joseph.
The iconic sound of John Coltrane. And stay tuned for news of an intriguing re-envisioning of John Coltrane's classic album, A Love Supreme, in London this month, marking the 50th anniversary of his classic album. Also on today's programme, I'll be joined by author Richard Havers, celebrating the release of his new book, Uncompromising Expression, looking at 75 years of the influential Blue Note label.
And then when the 60s happened, he put black faces on records.
That's right.
Which even Motown, to begin with, weren't doing. Mm. Motown were very conscious of the fact they were trying to appeal, in their mind, in America in the 1960s, a very different place, and but not Blue Note. Mm. They were right in there, and that was a groundbreaking move.
And more insights from author Richard Havers, plus some classic sounds deep from the Blue Note vaults later on the show. Plus, tonight's concert set highlights feature one of the most celebrated contemporary exponents of the saxophone in Joshua Redman, recorded at the Concert House in Vienna. Joshua Redman, with the addition of some beautiful string work courtesy of the Vienna Chamber Orchestra, and stay tuned for that very special set later on the programme. Let's start things off with a new release. It's from pianist and favourite son of New Orleans, Henry Butler, in collaboration with Sex Mob trumpeter and musical director for Anthony and the Johnsons, Steve Bernstein. Butler reflects a distinguished lineage of pianists from the Crescent City that include Professor Longhair, James Booker, and Jelly Roll Morton. Bernstein has travelled a great jazz journey through all the big eras. He's devised the slide trumpet and plays with the spirit and intention of the masters. Listen to these two musicians bring their own take on Fats Waller's Viper's Drag. Henry Butler with Steve Bernstein and The Hot Nine, and that was Viper's Drag, which is also the title of the album. Vibrant music played with an honest and energetic spirit. This album definitely celebrates the joy and irresistible sound of jazz from its beginnings with rhythm, melody, and energy worthy of this golden age. Viper's Drag is out now on the Impulse label. Well, from one iconic label to another, Blue Note Records. And the label is reverberating with extra power this year, as their first recording was committed to vinyl in 1939, which means this defining label celebrates 75 years of excellent music making that truly evangelized America's finest music, jazz, to the world. I'll be speaking to the author Richard Havers, responsible for writing the Blue Note book, Uncompromising Expression, which is huge. It's informative and has much more in common with an encyclopedia. But first, one of their earliest signings and an artist of absolutely mammoth status, who recently was awarded a blue plaque for his time living in London in 1922. This is Sidney Bechet and Summertime. Thank you. Sidney Bechet and Summertime from 1939 on Blue Note Records, one of the first records to be released on the label. And I welcome the author of this fantastic new book, Richard Havers. Richard, welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much, Julian.
Well, it's such a big, big project. There's so many albums, so many artists. My first question to you is, were you aware of the mammoth size of Blue Note in the whole jazz canon, really?
Yes. I mean, I've been a Blue Note fan not as long as I've been a fan of jazz, because I started via Jimmy Smith and Verve.
Right.
Not realising, of course, that Jimmy Smith started on Blue Note. That's right. But my way into jazz was through Jimmy. And but it was soon after that. This was in the mid-60s. So it was as before the 60s were out, I discovered Blue Note. And I discovered Jimmy Smith's Blue Note recordings first. And right. And then I went on a journey like lots of people do.
Absolutely. So Uncompromising Expression is the name of the book. What does that mean? Did you have the title before you had the book?
Yes. Yes, because I met with Don Was, who's the president of Blue Note. Mm-hmm. And he'd seen the book I did about Verve and wanted to do this book about Blue Note to mm-hmm. celebrate 75 years. And Don and I sat down in New York. He looked at the Verve book and said, we've got a bit of a problem here because this is so great and the right. Blue Note book has got to be better. So that was a challenge.
Yeah.
And his whole ethos for Blue Note is about uncompromising expression. Mm. And it comes from the very first press release that Blue Note put out back in 1939.
From Max Margolis.
Max Margolis, yeah. Exactly. And he wrote this wonderful paragraph, maybe tinges of his communist left leanings, but a manifesto for the label.
Right.
That manifesto of uncompromising expressions has been, I mean, certainly throughout Alfred Lion's time at the label, and thereafter, and right up through Bruce Lundvall, who resurrected the label in the 1980s, mm-hmm. through to Don, who runs it now. Don every day says, that is what I get up for. I get up to try and bring uncompromising expression to the music of Blue Note.
So what was your plan for the book? How did you plan to actually write the book? Because it's so big.
Yeah, in other words, there was another challenge again because of the Verve book, because that was laid out in the way it was, which was great.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to do another one because told a bigger story of jazz to put into perspective where Norman Granz got to. But whereas Blue Note, it's this wonderful story that, you know, starts in Germany and in pre-Nazi Germany and then into Nazi Germany. So that was my starting point. It does start at the beginning, but it's this idea of Alfred Lion escaping Germany to go and live in America and to start a record label. So that was the easy bit, if you like, the chronological part of the story. But in terms of laying it out, I mean, I picked 75 albums that I think tell the story of Blue Note Records, and that becomes the thread through the book. But more importantly, it's this evolving story of how a man who, I mean, he didn't quite get up one morning and say, I'm going to start a record label, but it wasn't far off that.
Right.
I mean, I don't think he really knew what he was starting. I mean, he'd met the guys who'd started Commodore Records
right.
in New York, and so that was sort of his motive. But where that was going to take him, of course, he didn't really know. And of course, when he started the label in 1939, there weren't albums. There weren't long-playing records.
Right.
That didn't come along for another decade.
Yeah.
So the technology changed how he ran his business. Obviously, developments in jazz changed how Blue Note ran, because Blue Note started as a label that was, you know, the music of Sidney Bechet that we just played. I mean, that was the beginning. It was hot jazz. It was much more of a traditional jazz. And then along came bebop, and Blue Note got on board.
So how important was Bechet for the beginning of this label?
Well, I think if it hadn't have been for Summertime, the label may not have continued, because it's one thing wanting to start a record label, but you've got to make money.
Mm.
And how do you, if you've got no marketing infrastructure, I mean, in a time when marketing wasn't really thought about, but distribution was Alfred Lion's problem.
Mm-hmm.
And he luckily got some record shops to stock his records, and he did some mail order. But that isn't going to sustain a business. But along comes Summertime, a fantastic recording. I mean, it's just everything that's magical mm-hmm. about that period. He was selling, you know, 30 a day at one point, which is a lot of records for a fledgling label in those
Absolutely.
Days. And they were more expensive than general records. So he was making enough money to sustain his business. And that was why Summertime was so important.
So we go from 1939 into the 40s. The 40s is, as you rightly stated, when bebop is really burgeoning. There's a whole new style of music coming about. And how did Blue Note manage to traverse that or get on board or even be a part of it?
Well, Thelonious Monk.
Yeah.
I think if they hadn't have signed Thelonious Monk, maybe the label would have floundered at that point.
Sure.
I mean, we can't if and but about these things, but I think, you know, it was Monk. Ike Quebec brought Monk to Blue Note.
Yeah.
It was that moment when the light bulb winked on, I think, for Alfred Lion. This is the future.
You
know, clearly bebop is where we're going.
Yeah.
And so Monk coming along, and then Art Blakey being involved with Monk, and then being involved with his own band and Horace Silver and the Jazz Messengers. And so that's when it all started to take off between the late 40s and the early 1950s. At the same time, of course, that's when LPs came along.
Yes.
Which gave the label a whole new start, a whole new opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
But that almost also made it impossible for them to continue because they had to retool their catalogue to release them as LPs.
Sure.
Which was a hugely expensive job for an independent label. So again, there was that conflict between the art and the business.
Mm.
And I think what was remarkable in those early days was they managed to, you know, get to the next level. And I think if you look at Blue Note throughout its history with Alfred at the helm, there was a series of these challenges that they managed to get over constantly. And that was certainly the first.
So we just got to about the 1950s. And I think by the 1950s, it says in your book, rightly, that Blue Note had found their stride. They had found their identity. And particularly with, and it's always been with huge musical characters. And one of the most important characters, I mean, you've got Thelonious Monk, Bud Powell, Fats Navarro, Herbie Nichols, a very, very unique musician, similar in uniqueness to Monk, but completely different in his music. And then we come to, I guess, the sound that defines Blue Note, people like Art Blakey and Horace Silver.
Absolutely.
Well, we're going to come to the look of Blue Note after we hear from Horace Silver's album Song for My Father, and this is The Natives Are Restless.
Thank you.
The Natives Are Restless from Horace Silver's classic album Song for My Father. And if you want to know the personnel, that was Carmel Jones on trumpet, Joe Henderson on the tenor saxophone, Teddy Smith was on bass, Roger Humphreys was on drums, and on the piano, Horace Silver. A great piece of music we just listened to. But what about the look of Blue Note?
Well, everybody obviously thinks of Reed Miles' designs mm-hmm. for Blue Note. Mm-hmm. But if you go back to the first LPs that came out, they were designed by a man called Paul Bacon, mm-hmm. who is 93.
Wow.
I talked to Paul. It was a fascinating conversation. But people have slightly forgotten about his designs, but the early Monk albums, that was Paul. Mm. And they very much had that look of the time, but they were very good. But when Reed came along, of course, everything changed.
Right.
Reed's brilliance of taking Francis Wolff's photography,
yeah.
Alfred Lion's partner, who is also German, who escaped in September 1939 with Alfred's help to America. He took these amazing photographs, which now, I think that's what everybody thinks of, jazz photography. They think of Francis Wolff's photographs because
yeah.
they're just that black and white photograph. But one of the things that was interesting to me, Michael Koskuna, who worked at Blue Note for many years and is now the looks after Francis's archive, said that to me that what always annoyed him was the fact that his photographs, Reed would come along and crop them.
Right.
So one of the things we put in the book is where we've got the Chinagraph pencil crop marks.
Yeah.
And he would say to Reed, but I photographed it properly in the first place. Why are you doing it differently? You know, because like an artist, he thought he'd got it captured.
But yes.
I think it's that genius of Reed to see how to crop a picture, but especially the typography that looks now. You look at a Blue Note cover from, 59, 60, it could have been done yesterday.
Yeah.
And it's influenced album design, not just in jazz, but in every field of music.
That's
and
right.
I suspect there'll be an interesting book to show the development of album design from the Blue Note era.
Mm.
It was cutting edge. And then when the 60s happened, again, there was it wasn't so much Francis's photography then, but what Reed was very clever at doing was doing something that nobody else was doing. He put black faces on records.
That's right.
Which even Motown, to begin with, weren't doing. Mm. Motown were very conscious of the fact they were trying to appeal in their mind in America in the 1960s, a very different place, and but not Blue Note.
Mm.
They were right in there,
yeah.
And that was a groundbreaking move again. And people have perhaps, the reason why necessarily why they should know it, but it's kind of one of those little things that has been glossed over in the history of Blue Note.
Well, the team really worked, didn't it? Alfred Lion, Reed Miles, and Francis Wolff. You've got this great team of, and Rudy Van Gelder, let me not forget that. And so many other characters involved in the music. It's the 60s now, and they've signed Herbie Hancock. They've got Joe Henderson. Lee Morgan's having a big hit with Sidewinder. It's interesting that Herbie Hancock talks about Alfred Lion's shuffle when they were recording. And if he shuffled, it meant that he was feeling the music and that it was a good take. And that you would just, that was the take once you got him moving. And I think that's wonderful. The team is working. The albums are coming out thick and fast. The quality is immensely high. I mean, it's very hard to find a bad Blue Note record from this period. What, in your opinion, having researched this and looked through it and written the book, caused its decline?
I think it was a mixture of Alfred leaving.
Mm-hmm.
Alfred's health was not good, so he'd sold the company to Liberty.
Yeah.
I think he was thinking, I'm going to cash in on my investment, because I don't think he made it. Him and Francis didn't make a lot of money when they were running Blue Note.
Right.
I think they ploughed a lot of their money back into making a better record label and so on. They made a good living, but it wasn't a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
So selling to Liberty, getting involved in a big corporation, and there's a I've seen some correspondence where Frank Wolff talks about having to answer company memos, which I don't suppose ever happened in Blue Note.
No.
It was a conversation between the two of them, and that was about it.
Yeah.
But also, rock music came along, changing tastes. That middle 60s, suddenly rock music was, in a way, the new jazz, because this was not pop music. It wasn't 3-minute singles. Mm. It was US radio going, hey, we can play 7-8 minute tracks.
Yeah.
Then along, rock music started to expand, started to be different. Mm. A band like Blood, Sweat and Tears mixed jazz with rock. Mm. And lots of people who perhaps would have in the previous years been attracted to Blue Note were going off on the rock journey.
Sure.
And I think jazz just lost its way a little bit, lost its fan base. And, you know, I'm not saying you need a fan base to develop the music, but it certainly helps from an economic point of view.
Or relevance to popular culture.
Relevance to popular culture too. The Woodstock generation, 1969, they were looking for something else. Mm-hmm. And Blue Note went off in a different direction. I mean, mm-hmm. I like some of that early 70s Donald Byrd Blue Note. I love that funk stuff. And obviously as time's gone along, acid jazz and hip hop have embraced that period in particular and gone back into the earlier Blue Note. And one of the things I found out was that the most sampled Blue Note record is actually Lou Donaldson's Ode to Billy Joe. And it's sampled because there's this fantastic drum bit at the beginning. Yeah. That's the bit that's sampled Blue Note 900 times.
Wow.
But there's so many records
like that,
that have been sampled, and that has introduced a whole new generation to Blue Note.
It's exciting for Blue Note that 75 years later, they're still relevant, current, putting out great artists, and successful. And where do you think, having had a look over the whole of the history of Blue Note, where do you think Blue Note are going?
Well, with Don Was at the helm, they could go anywhere.
Right.
Because that's the spirit of Blue Note. Mm. The spirit of Blue Note isn't, it has to be this.
Mm.
It is uncompromising expression. And Don, you know, the heritage of Blue Note attracts artists to Blue Note. People go to Don and say, I want to be on Blue Note. Just like Norah Jones said, I want to be on Blue Note. I grew up listening to Blue Note. That's who I want to be. So the likes of the Glaspers, the likes of Jose James and Gregory Porter, they want to be on Blue Note. And as other artists who are operating, not just in the jazz arena, but in that, and I don't want to say the fringes of music, because it's not right, but people who are not necessarily mainstream, I think the whole idea of Blue Note appeals to them. So I think we're going to continue to see exciting records coming from Blue Note. And who knows what those are going to be, but I know they're going to be great.
Richard Havers, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your opinions and your enthusiasm for such a great label as Blue Note. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Julian.
And we're going to go out now on Gregory Porter and from his latest album on Blue Note called Liquid Spirit. This is the title track, Liquid Spirit.
Unreroute the rivers, let the damned water beat. There's some people down the way that's thirsty, so let the liquid spirit free. The people are thirsty because of man's unnatural hand. Watch what happens when the people catch wind, when the water hits the banks of that hard, dry land. Clap your hands now. Go ahead and clap your hands now. Clap your hands now. Go ahead and clap your hands now. Get ready for the wave. It might strike like a final flood. The people haven't drank in so long, the water won't even make mud. After it comes, it might come with a steady flow. Grab the roots of the tree down by the river. Dip your cup when your spirit's low. Clap your hands now. Go ahead and clap your hands now. Clap your hands now. Clap your hands now. Dip down and take a drink and fill your water tank. Dip down and take a drink and fill your water tank. Thank you.
Unreroute the rivers, let the damned water beat. There's some people down the way that's thirsty, let the liquid spirit free. The folk are thirsty because of man's unnatural hand. Watch what happens when the people catch wind of the water hidden banks of hard, dry land. Clap your hands now. Clap your hands now. Go ahead and clap your hands now. Clap your hands now. Dip down and take a drink and fill your water tank. Dip down, take a drink and fill your water tank. Liquid spirit. Liquid spirit. Liquid spirit. Liquid spirit. Clap your hands now. Liquid spirit.
Gregory Porter and Liquid Spirit out on the Blue Note label. And fascinating insights there from author Richard Havers, all contained in his book Uncompromising Expression, 75 Years of the Finest in Jazz, and it's out now and published by Thames and Hudson. This is Jazz Lineup on BBC Radio 3 with me, Julian Joseph, on FM, online and on digital radio. Now, flautist Roland Sutherland thrives in a variety of musical situations, having worked with the Jazz Warriors, a bevy of African and Brazilian greats, and numerous symphony orchestras. So, he's put together a 15-piece ensemble to offer his own view on a John Coltrane masterpiece. Originally commissioned as part of the Meltdown Festival at the South Bank a few years ago, Sutherland brings his extravaganza to the Union Chapel on the 9th of December to celebrate 50 years since the recording of the towering spiritual offering, A Love Supreme. The ensemble palette makes full use of percussion, vocals, keyboards, electronics, woodwinds, and horns played by star musicians, including drummer Mark Mondesi, pianist Nicky Yeo, vocalist Cleveland Watkiss, kora and cellist Tunde Jagedi, woodwind artist Shabaka Hutchings, Steve Williamson on saxophones, and Roland Sutherland on flutes. Coltrane only ever performed A Love Supreme live once in concert, I believe, on June the 26th, 1965, at Festival Mondial du Jazz Antibes, Juan-les-Pins, France. Well, let's compare and contrast the live and studio versions. Here's a taster from that live recording, a fascinating insight introduced here by André Garrison. This is Acknowledgement.
Place à quatre musiciens qui sont parmi les plus importants du monde contemporain dans le domaine du jazz. À la batterie, Elvin Jones. À la contrebasse, Jimmy Garrison. Au piano, McCoy Tyner. Et le saxophoniste, John Coltrane. John Coltrane interprétera un thème, enfin une composition en plusieurs mouvements qu'il a enregistré récemment en disque aux États-Unis. Le titre en est Love Supreme.
Truly fascinating historical recording from the stage of the Festival Mondial du Jazz en Tibes, Juan-les-Pins, France, documenting the only ever live version of A Love Supreme by the composer John Coltrane. Well, let's go back further in time to Englewood Cliffs in New Jersey to Rudy Van Gelder's recording studio and hear the iconic studio version recorded exactly 50 years ago this month on December 9th, 1964. This is Acknowledgement. We'll be right back. Featuring McCoy Tyner on piano, Jimmy Garrison on bass, and Elvin Jones on drums, that was tenor saxophonist John Coltrane, and acknowledgement from A Love Supreme. And 50 years to the day, Roland Sutherland brings his re-envisioning to the Union Chapel for a concert on December 9th, marking the 50th anniversary of A Love Supreme. Joining him will be musical director Orphee Robinson, Ansuman Biswas, and Pat Thomas, amongst a cast of stars from the British music scene. And for more information on that concert, check out the Jazz Lineup page via the Radio 3 website. So, to tonight's highlights of a concert set, which comes from one of the most celebrated saxophonists in jazz today, Joshua Redman. Redman's latest recording, Walking Shadows, is an album of ballads produced by long-term collaborator and excellent pianist Brad Meldow. He plays with a quartet that features pianist Aaron Goldberg, Reuben Rogers on bass, drummer Gregory Hutchinson, and the Vienna Chamber Orchestra with conductor Gerd Hermann Ortler. But before we hear tonight's concert set highlights, let's link up with the man responsible for programming this concert, Peter Polanski from the Concert House in Vienna. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Julian.
How long have you been programming jazz at the Vienna Concert House?
Well, we started our very first concert in 1994 when we produced a show with Jerry Mulligan Quartet. And that was a successful kickoff for the idea to present jazz in that year. The idea was, you know, Wiener Konzerthaus is one of the most prestigious classic concert venues in Europe, maybe worldwide as well, mm-hmm. presenting sort of 500 shows a year, mainly in the classical field. And my idea was from the very beginning when I started working there to get jazz music, a music that is really an intellectual art form, music form, on the same stage of presentation as we do with all these beautiful and high-end chamber music, symphony music, and so on. So after we've seen that there's really a bunch of people interested within our own society, the Concert House is a non-profit society, we decided to have a kickoff. Funnily, I realized that in the very first series, Joshua Redman was scheduled. So there's a long connection to this character. And we started with six shows. We've been very successful on that, which means we just sold out, which was a big surprise. As you can imagine, everybody was expecting we are doing a new program, mm-hmm. attracting to a new audience. Yeah. But in fact, it ended up that the whole series was sold out by our own subscribers used to join our classical music. And there was were no tickets available for the people outside. There was really very tough program. Like we've presented Bill Holman's orchestra, we've presented Maria Schneider's orchestra, the Village Vanguard. So none of these, let's call it, commercially successful bands and characters on the scene in those days.
Right, but just a particular spirit of getting the true music to the public and bringing something special in this special venue.
We are serving this music to this audience that's really interested to join a concert to be concentrated on what happens on stage.
Right.
So you sit down and you don't listen to the orders next on the next table or the discussions about how the weekend was with your wife or with the neighbor. And the same thing is to bring on stage a very concentrated situation for the artists themselves. So that's the one thing.
I see. So let's get back to Joshua Redman. And he was one of the first artists that you invited. So you have this long association with him. And for this particular concert, which is a special concert with the Vienna Chamber Orchestra, what drew you to putting on this particular concert? I mean, it seems with the release of the Walking Shadows album, it seemed like a natural fit.
You know, the funny thing was... first of all, I have to say, I'm really mad about writing.
Right.
I love composition. I love arrangements. I like the intellectual part of the structure and the improvisation. So we talked about why not doing a commission in particular for that show if we have this opportunity working with Josh, his band, and this chamber orchestra.
And I think this aspect of writing and dealing with the intellectual side of jazz and giving it a platform and even talking about it, putting it into the discussion and setting it in its own setting is such an important thing to do.
So yes.
Well, tell us about the concert in particular. How was the performance, the evening for you? You were there. We're going to hear some of it, obviously.
Yeah. Well, the most beautiful thing to me, really from the very first rehearsal on, there was a beautiful interaction between the soloists and the orchestra, that there was no problem in conversation, musical sense, that
right.
they were clear about a sound to get together within, I would say, in the very first setting of the rehearsal. So sitting in there, in this very relaxed atmosphere, finally, yeah? Mostly, if you're going into this, the soloists have no idea about the orchestra,
right.
and so on. So it's not really... always that relaxed, and
of
this
course.
Became so beautiful from the very beginning, and it was so beautiful to see how the Joshua, Aaron, and all of them reacted on the situation.
Right.
So it was very clear that this will be a gorgeous evening. Then finally,
well, I'm sure that Gerd Hermann Ortler had a lot to do with that, as
okay.
both the conductor and somebody very sensitive to jazz.
Definitely, this was my very, very lucky shot in this whole production. This is a very young character. I mean, this is a new generation, new type of musician, well-educated in both fields.
Yeah.
And so these guys are burning, and he brought into this production, really, we've met 2 years in advance for that thing. We brought Joshua for the first talk with Gerhard to Vienna. And so I have to thank a lot to Gerd for this success, because he put the right orchestra, the right setting in the orchestra together. Mm. He worked out all details. I have no idea what to do. I mean, I'm a producer. I'm not and that was really brilliant. So there was a lot of trust in advance from Josh's side then.
Right.
I knew already that this will work with the chamber orchestra.
Well, this is the thing, Peter. It seems there's a renaissance happening in Vienna once again, thanks to
Absolutely.
Your clever programming and sensitive programming. Thank you so much, Peter, for sharing your insights and enthusiasm for this concert with me. Let's get straight to the music. This is Joshua Redman and his band with the Vienna Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Gerd Hermann Ortler.
Reuben Rogers. Thank you. Thank you. We would like to continue by
playing another song from Walking Shadows. This is an old standard called Easy Living, arranged by a great friend and brilliant pianist and colleague of all of ours, Brad Meldow. Easy Living. Thank you. Now we are going to continue. There's a brand new composition of Gerd's that's been commissioned for this event. And I was so excited to play it until I actually saw the music and realized that I couldn't play it. But I've been working at it, and bear with me, maestro. Anyway, this is a fantastic composition of his called Stained Glass, and it features myself and Aaron and the Vienna Chamber Orchestra.
Thank you.
Joshua Redman with the composition Stained Glass, ending tonight's highlights from a concert set recorded at the Concert House in Vienna, Austria. He performed with Aaron Goldberg on piano, Ruben Rogers on bass, Gregory Hutchinson on the drums, and the Vienna Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Gerd Hermann Ortler, who also composed that last specially commissioned piece. And for more information on Joshua Redman and for the tracks featured on tonight's show, check out the links on the Jazz Lineup page via the Radio 3 website. Well, that's almost the end of this week's Jazz Lineup, but there's plenty more jazz on BBC Radio 3 with Jeffrey Smith's Jazz tonight at midnight and Jazz on 3 Monday night with Jez Nelson. This week, Jez presents music from this year's London Jazz Festival featuring US clarinetist Oren Etkin and the British septet Quadriceratops. And no Jazz Lineup next week, but I'll be back in 2 weeks' time with music from saxophonist Robbie Fowler. Plus, we're having a look at the Berlin jazz scene 25 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Well, to sign off with tonight, music from a bassist I recently bumped into at the Jazz on Tet Festival in France, where he was working with vocalist Zara McFarland, who picked up the Jazz Mobo Award this year. He also featured on a concert set last week that we broadcast with drummer Ollie Howell at the London Jazz Festival. And he's also a founder member of the British jazz group Particle. His name is Max Luther, and he releases a rich textured musical debut that includes his Particle buddy Duncan Eagles on the tenor sax. Matt Robinson is on piano and Dave Hamblett is on the drums. The album is called Orbital, and it showcases a gifted composer and bandleader and is just out now on the Worldwind Recordings label. This is The Edge Warp. Until next time, from me, Julian Joseph, bye-bye.
Was The Edge Wall, performed by Max Luther, ending this week's Jazz Lineup. The programme was produced in Glasgow by Sushil K. Dade. and presented by Julian Joseph. For more information on Jazz Lineup, just go to the programme page via the Radio 3 website. And Jazz Lineup will be back in 2 weeks at the later time of 9:15.
I bet you can name 3 award-winning contemporary authors. How about 3 award-winning artists? But 3 award-winning contemporary composers? That's where we come in. This week sees the 12th edition of the annual British Composer Awards taking place at Goldsmiths Hall in London, celebrating the talents behind some of the most beautiful, memorable, ingenious and well-crafted premieres of the last year. Hear the highlights and meet the composers themselves talking about the music that's most definitely here and now. Here and now with me, Andrew McGregor, and Sarah Moore-Peach at the British Composer Awards. 10 o'clock this evening here on BBC Radio 3.
It's just gone 7:30 this Saturday evening, and time now for Opera on 3, which this evening brings another chance to hear a special celebration, the Plácido Domingo Gala, an event that Radio 3 recorded back in October 2011. It took place at the Royal Opera House to commemorate the 40th anniversary of Domingo's first appearance at Covent Garden, and it's introduced by Andrew McGregor.
If I rest, I rust. That's the mantra of the singer whose extraordinary voice and career we're all gathered here to celebrate. Welcome to the Royal Opera House's Plácido Domingo celebration, where in his 70th birthday year, he returns to the stage he first graced exactly 40 years ago, and where he's appeared almost every year since. And the affection in which he's held here is palpable, and so's the thrill of anticipation in the auditorium. We know we're so fortunate to witness this special occasion. And I don't know about this Covent Garden audience, but even after seeing the dress rehearsal earlier this week, I can scarcely believe what we're going to hear. Domingo as both tenor and baritone, bringing us 3 great Verdi roles, fully staged, complete final acts from Otello, Rigoletto and Simon Boccanegra. Starting with the tenor role, many thought he was too young to sing when he first appeared as the Moor of Venice in the mid-70s. And here he is, almost 71 years old, still able to transfix us with his portrayal. This evening's conductor at the Royal Opera House is music director Antonio Pappano, and I couldn't resist asking him to try to explain what it's like having this voice in his hands.
Well, the voice, when you're listening to the voice, I mean, you still can't believe it. I mean, it really does sound like the recordings. It sounds like a silly thing to say, but the sense of wonder, I'll never forget the first time I conducted him. I think it was over 100 years ago, I think. It was in Tosca, and I was really green, but he started the first act aria, and I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. I just couldn't believe it. But his greatest gift is that when he's in a room rehearsing or on the stage performing, he makes everybody around him better. He takes the limelight because he's a star. He draws attention, but everybody around him just somehow ups their game, but they don't even realize they're doing it. There's a quality somehow just raises from everybody, and that's a wonderful thing to be around. I've seen it over and over and over again, and therefore it's never just the Plácido Domingo show. Everybody somehow is partaking and making the evening, you know, a success. It's a fantastic thing.
Conductor Antonio Pappano, and even at the dress rehearsal earlier this week, you could see the effect Domingo's presence was having on the rest of the cast. And not just on stage, the singers who weren't involved in the last act of Simon Boccanegra came and sat in the auditorium so that they didn't miss a note of Domingo's performance. The feelings of respect, admiration, even awe from his fellow singers is obvious. Domingo's not been giving interviews around this Royal Opera House celebration, but he did allow us into his dressing room backstage before the dress to find out more about the characters he's portraying in these 3 Verdi operas. So before we hear Domingo's reflections on Otello, I'd better do the story so far as we head for this performance of the final act. We're in 15th century Cyprus when the island was under Venetian control. The Moorish general Otello has been made governor and arrives with his bride Desdemona, winning a victory over the Turkish fleet. But Otello's ensign, Iago, isn't celebrating. Otello's made the mistake of promoting Cassio over Iago's head, and he's also jealous of Otello's success in battle, so Iago sets out to destroy them both. Cassio's brought down to size with ruthless efficiency. They get him drunk and provoke a fight, and a furious Otello strips Cassio of his rank as captain. In the second act, Iago's machinations turn to Otello. First, Cassio is persuaded to ask Desdemona to plead on his behalf to her husband, while Iago hints to Otello that Desdemona's in love with his former captain. But Otello needs proof, and Iago sets about furnishing it. Iago's wife, Emilia, is Desdemona's lady-in-waiting, and he forces her to hand over a handkerchief dropped by her mistress. Iago drips more poison in Otello's